Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast with no fixed opinions. My name is Corey Hazeless and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
We are having another one, I'm really excited listeners, another one of our semi-regular episodes where Steve lets me talk about the British Constitution.
When we're done with this crisis, if we're not talking about the Constitution for the next 2 years.
We'll be talking about the Constitution like Europe, Steve, for the next 15 years.
I did say when we're done with the crisis.
But Europe is part of the reason we're in a constitutional crisis and therefore we're getting ahead of ourselves. So we will do a few more of these over the next few months, whether Steve wants me to or not, because of the ongoing constitutional crisis, or if we're going to give it its less scaremongery term, the current coup that we're going through. This episode in particular is going to be about the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. We're recording at a moment where there hasn't been an election triggered yet. Our Prime Minister, or at least at the moment, Boris Johnson, tried to get one through under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act and failed. This is more going to be a bit of a step back and have a think about why was that act passed, what was the aim of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, and what are its implications. Parliaments Act, Steve, was agreed by the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats in their coalition agreement of 2010. I've seen a few people on Twitter almost try and blame the Lib Dems and the Tories for the fact that we've got this terrible, terrible Fixed Term Act. Do you want to have a guess which political parties had fixed term parliaments in their 2010 election manifesto?
I'm going to guess Labour?
Yes.
So and only Labour.
Labour and the Lib Dems had fixed term parliaments in their manifesto. The Conservatives didn't have it in their manifesto. They're not really that hot on constitutional reform. Unlike the Labour Party, which is a hotbed of such... never mind. What the Conservatives had in their manifesto was they wanted to try and restrict the ability of the PM to use the royal prerogative in order to dissolve Parliament, call an election, and bring it more under the control of the House of Commons. So in that sense, the Lib Dems' Fixed Term Parliaments pledge and the Conservatives want to allow Parliament to have the power to call an election has kind of coalesced together.
Yeah, there's a definite kind of synergy between the two aims there, and you could see that the fixed-term parliaments would be one way to achieve what the Conservatives wanted.
There's an interesting, I think, issue in terms of how the Act came about, because essentially the point of the Act though became about safeguarding the coalition for 5 years, because certainly, and it's something that I think is slightly lost now in the interminable Lib Dem debates about was it right or wrong for the Lib Dems to enter coalition. What was on the minds very much of people at the time was that if there is no coalition, the Tories would have a minority government, and in 6 months' time, David Cameron would call an election, say, I need a majority, and get it, and then everyone would be screwed, and only the Tories would have money to campaign in that election. So I think it was also a recognition, both from the Tory and Lib Dem side, that the government was going to bring in spending cuts. They needed time for the economy to recover, and they didn't want the government collapsing before the economy recovered, because it might scupper their re-election chances.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what the original coalition agreement proposed was that an election would only be called if 55% of MPs voted for an election to be called. Now, at that time, the proportion of Lib Dem and Tory MPs was 58%, and Lib Dem and Labour MPs was 53%. So it was, the 55% was obviously a bit of a wheeze to say, well, we can't have the Lib Dems and Labour trying to bring down the government and end up with a Lib Lab coalition. But it also means that both Lib Dems and the Tories have to agree all together in order to dissolve Parliament and call an election. What happened in practice, though, is that figure of MPs needed was massively bumped up. So it became not 55% of MPs had to vote to call an election, had to be two-thirds.
It became a supermajority, because that massively is much more difficult to obtain.
The really interesting thing, I think, in terms of the way in which the Act came about in 2010, certainly if you read David Laws's account, which is the main account I've read of the coalition negotiations, is originally the plan, I think, was to have a four-year fixed-term parliament, which kind of makes sense, because under Thatcher in 79, 83, 87, and then Labour again, 97, 2001, 5, there'd been a sort of expectation you'd have an election every 4 years. Except, I think I'm right in saying, it was George Osborne who made a throwaway remark to the effect that we might need a five-year parliament just to make sure that the economy recovers in time. And Laws actually says, well, actually, if it had been a four-year parliament, if they'd gone for a 4 years fixed terms and the election was in May 2014, there's a very good chance Ed Miliband would have won that election.
Yeah.
The justification for bringing in fixed-term parliaments, basically, I think, seems, as the Conservatives kind of hinted in their manifesto pledge, it was to stop the PM from having that advantage of being able to call an election at a time of their choosing, which I've seen Mark Steele describe as it being a bit like a football team being able to decide when they stop the match.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the notion that the government is able to pick and choose when an election is absolutely farcical. It's a complete failure to separate powers and undermines a fundamental role of Parliament, which is holding the executive to account, because it means that there is an ability to just threaten people's jobs and their livelihoods as MPs by going, if you do not play nice, we're going to call an election and you may very well lose your job.
It's also in the past been a bit of an incentive to ramp up the economy in a way that wasn't necessarily sensible. So in the 50s, for instance, the Tory election victories of Eden in 1955 and McMillan in 1959, especially in 59, there were accusations that some sort of artificial boom had been created. I think I'm right in saying that in 1959, the Tories cut income tax by 6 pence in the pound, and then just, that was before the election, and then right after the election, just put it back on again. It was just this kind of artificial, like,
it's like electioneering. The barefaced cheek of that is in some ways quite admirable, that they even thought to go to that level of ridiculousness.
Well, you know, the Conservatives obviously have a massive appetite for staying and keeping power, and yeah, as we've seen from the last, never mind. So, but I suppose more recently, the 2001 election, I think it was delayed because of the foot and mouth crisis.
Yeah.
So it was pushed back. I think it was meant to be in May, it was in June or something, or July. But in terms of the PM being able to call an election when he wants, that's been a bit of a double-edged sword. So, I mean, there's times like Wilson in 66, where he's able to increase his majority. But then, actually, Harold Wilson in 1970 calls an election early and loses. Ted Heath does the same in 1974. The Parliament had another 18 months to run. He didn't have to go to the country on the Who Governs Britain, but loses that election. So it has actually been a little bit of a double-edged sword. And Theresa May 2 years ago. Like, I suppose we had the fixed-term parliaments in force then, but just being able to set the date at when you call an election hasn't always been favourable for a Prime Minister.
No, absolutely. I mean, the elections are very volatile things, as we've seen over the past few elections. But fundamentally, I think for me, the issue is not necessarily the fact that they can call the election whenever they want, because as you say, that can work for them. It can also screw them up quite badly. The issue is more the fact that it is a threat against the legislature, a threat against Parliament that says, you know, you need to toe the party line, otherwise you could be out of a job. And that is something, for instance, that I believe John Major did at least once during his time. Now, granted, you know, I think that was against the Bastards, as they were known, who have now taken over the Conservative Party. So in some ways, might be quite understandable to kind of threaten them in that sort of way. But it's still not a good thing for the executive to have that sort of power, because it fundamentally undermines the ability of Parliament to hold them to account.
Mm. I think the problem in terms of how the legislation was drafted is this was obviously just a short-term thing to keep the coalition in power. Mm-hmm. And so although, yes, fixed-term Parliament's good thing, good to fix the election date, actually, this was essentially just to keep the marriage of convenience together. And as it turned out, Clegg and Cameron worked a lot better together than probably actually either of their parties expected or
I suspect even they thought we would.
Yeah. But in now we've got this kind of anomaly on the constitution, which works in a really, really funny way that no other country in Europe really has it. Although there is one country that has a fixed term, applies for fixed terms. Do you know which that is?
In Europe?
Yeah. Well, I'm going off the Vernon Bognor book, who gives examples of someone who's got a fixed term Parliaments Act in this way.
I don't know, Luxembourg?
They're often used as a Brexit model.
Switzerland?
The other one.
Norway.
Norway.
Okay.
So there are fixed terms in Norway. And it's interesting, especially when we think about the power that we want Parliament to have, because the idea of the fixed terms in Norway is specifically to make sure that parties work together. So in other words, you can't just throw your Tories out of the pram and have an election. You've got to work with the other party come what may. And in Norway, there's meant to be a more striving for consensus. So it's not adversarial as in Britain. It's meant to be the governing party actually works with the opposition quite a bit on matters like this. And obviously, Norway has PR. It has proportional representation, which, as we know, is a proper voting system. Unlike first past the post, which is a massive pile of dog willis. And I think part of the problem, and it's what we're kind of seeing now, is in Britain we have a very adversarial system. The whole system is designed to stop parties from working together. And what I think we're seeing is it's very, very hard for parties to try and come together and actually make things work in a scenario like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the current situation we're in is a kind of a massive testament to that.
And actually, so a lot of the stuff that I've got from Fixed Term Parliaments, it comes from Vernon Bognor's book, which was it's on the coalition and the constitution. And he says in there, in the throwaway line, that if Parliament becomes more difficult to dissolve, it increases the possibility of a lame duck government. And I suppose in countries like the US, where there are proper fixed terms in terms of presidencies, you can get that, can't you? That kind of year to 18 months where essentially nothing can get done because one party controls the legislature and another one controls the presidency.
Pretty much every president towards the tail end of their presidency ends up as a lame duck in some capacity, just because, you know, the inevitable swings of democracy means that the opposition is going to probably take over the House or the Senate, which means a lot of the policy that the president wants to put through is going to be difficult to get through and might even be impossible as a result.
I think we should probably go on to maybe a bigger question. So
there are bigger questions than the Constitution?
Well, in terms of the conceptual reasons why we try and have a constitution, how we want to frame a constitution. And we've talked about the fact that the Fixed Term Parliaments Act was essentially a device to keep a coalition in power for 5 years and then accidentally was on a statute book. I mean, my favourite fact when I was researching this episode is an obscure quote from then a newly elected batch banker. It was an obscure quote from an obscurely newly re-elected backbencher called Jacob Rees-Mogg, who you might have heard of, last seen sleeping in the House of Commons. And he basically says, well, the best reason for voting for this act is because it will have no impact whatsoever.
Which is just balmy at the best kind of view you can take of it, because it was quite clear that with this act, even though it was intended to be like a sticking plaster just for the coalition, if it goes onto the statute book, it was going to have some quite drastic potential effects. And yes, it might have only happened in niche cases, but guess what? The world's gone crazy and we're now just surrounded by niche edge cases for everything.
Well, I think what's interesting is everyone and certainly Bogdanov, I think, in the book, kind of assumes, well, the opposition will probably call for an election too, because you don't want to be called chicken like Jeremy Corbyn's been doing. But actually, that hasn't proved to be the case. And I think the kind of interesting bigger question then is, do we have parliamentary government or do we have democratic government? So in other words, is it that Parliament chooses the government. So essentially we elect Steve McCabe, hashtag stick with Steve, as our MP for Selly Oak. And he, if his party is the largest party, then the person he chooses to be leader of his party becomes Prime Minister.
Yep.
So Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister because he leads the largest party. Okay. Or is it that the people choose the government and therefore the government's accountable to the people? Now, usually those things go hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah.
Usually, because under first-past-the-post majoritarian government, if you voted for Labour and Steve McCabe in Selly Oak, you then would get a Labour government under Jeremy Corbyn. However, that isn't necessarily true, given that we're going to a multi-party system. As we've said already in the podcast, the two-party system is breaking down a little bit. What could happen at a future election is a Labour coalition or minority government confidence to supply, what have you, with the Lib Dems or the SNP or both, or even more parties than that, which you could argue that no one voted for, although I also feel like a big part of the election campaign would be the fact that that's all we talk about in the election was the coalition negotiations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it that you vote for your MP and he chooses the government and the government's accountable to the MPs, or is it that the people choose the government and the government's elected to the people?
Well, as it happens in practice, it is you vote for your MP, and then the MP is part of a party, and then whichever party has the largest support in the parliament, they form the government. But that's not how we view democracy. That's not how we frame the narrative of the vote. It's you go and you vote for the people that you want to form the government. Like we've said before, that actually MPs don't necessarily, individual MPs don't necessarily shift the vote that much in their constituency. You can have a very good MP who works their arse off for 5 years and will get booted out just on national swing. There's not really any kind of local advantage that an MP gets. There's small ones in your first election, your first re-election attempt at re-election, but broadly it is very minimal.
And certainly British election campaigns over the last 30-40 years have got a lot more presidential, and so the whole thing has been, you know, stable government with me, David Cameron, or Tony Blair putting himself on the front page of election leaflets, or people saying, well, I'm voting for Maggie, you know, not necessarily voting Conservative. Problem is, as the two-party system breaks down, that won't hold anymore, because even under our stupid electoral system, we're going to have more hung parliaments, more coalitions, and more minority governments. So, just to take a hypothetical scenario, let's assume that someone's going to change the Fixed Term Parliaments Act in some way.
Yeah.
Because essentially, we're in a farcical situation where there isn't really a majority for anything at the moment in Parliament, other than we don't want Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and we don't want a no-deal Brexit. So let's assume that someone amends the Fixed Term Parliaments Act to say that you just need a majority of MPs to dissolve Parliament and call an election. I can't see someone dissolving the Fixed Term Parliament, like repealing it completely, but I can see a situation where you say, all right, we'll give it to Parliament instead. Simple majority.
Yeah.
Okay. But let's say they keep in the bit where if there's a vote of no confidence in a government and it's successful, there are 2 more weeks to find an alternative government. So let's posit a hypothetical scenario. Let's say there's a Liberal Democrat Conservative coalition that is formed at the end of an election.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say for some reason the Lib Dems want to pull out of that coalition and join Labour.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Let's say the Lib Dems and Labour get together and they put a vote of no confidence in the government.
Yep.
The Lib Dems vote against the government. They bring down that government and form a coalition with Labour.
Yep.
I suppose the question is then, should the public have to vote on that new coalition?
I mean, this basically boils down to the same kind of notion of nobody elected Gordon Brown, nobody elected Boris Johnson. It basically boils down to the notion that if you have a change of government of any sort, should there be an election to justify that government being in power, whether that be of a single party or multi-parties. Fundamentally, that's something that I don't think there is necessarily an easy answer to.
Well, no, well, as I said before, it's the difference between parliamentary government and democratic government. But the question is, which one do we want?
Either way, you look to go, you then end up in a position where you need to make significant changes, potentially, to the British Constitution, such as it is, to actually make it work. Because either you need to move to a more kind of like general democracy. Well, it's not quite direct democracy, is it? But it's like, you know, a more
participatory.
More participatory democracy approach, which is a complete drastic shift from where we are currently. Or you need to move back towards a more parliamentary representative democracy approach, which requires a change in framing and a change in narrative and a change in education as to how government and things work. Now, I suspect what we'll probably end up doing is moving towards the participatory democracy kind of direction, just because I think that's the trend more generally across a lot of the world. I think whether it's the best outcome, to a degree, irrelevant, I think that's kind of where we're going to be headed, almost just by virtue of the trends and how people view politicians. If you don't like politicians, why would you want to entrust them with more power?
Well, but I think actually, in terms of the British tradition we've got, it's more parliamentary government.
Absolutely.
So I can see that tradition carrying on, if only because I'm not sure that MPs will necessarily want to give themselves the power just to call random elections. I think the incentive for MPs is to reduce the amount of elections there are. And given that at the moment there isn't a constitutional requirement for a new Prime Minister to call an election, it would make sense that an amendment to the Fixed Term Parliaments Act means that actually if there's a situation where the Lib Dems leave the Tory coalition and join the Labour one, there wouldn't need to be an election. And I think that's fine. The only thing is then, it needs to go. I don't think we'll necessarily see a more participatory in terms of more referendums and what have you, because I think actually there's going to be a bit of a backlash against the idea of referendums from quite a lot of the public. Or at least, if there is going to be one, then we need to have a proper written constitution and a proper device for solving how we sort out referendums. And also, if we're going to change the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, you kind of need to change the voting system, because it needs to almost be a bit of a tacit admission that parties are going to have to work together more. If you're going to have an act like this, if you don't then change more of the constitution, we're just going to end up in another stupid crisis further down the line.
Oh, certainly, yeah. But the one thing that the position that Britain's constitution is effectively based on tradition and is uncodified and is just, it is the way it is because it is the way it is essentially how it is in reality. That means people and politicians of any stripe, and even academics other than a select few, and people who study and commentate on politics for a living, don't pay much attention to the constitution, which means you're not necessarily going to see the level of thought that even you've just put into it there to say, if X, then Y. I think we are almost bound to continue falling into the pit traps on this, because I don't think people are going to move in the right direction.
We've just spent the last month talking all about those pitfalls, haven't we? Like, I think the whole point, like, part of the reason we're having this conversation is because Brexit and the process in which we've had Brexit, the process in which we've got to a referendum, the process in which we now have a House of Commons where nothing can be voted for. Like, in the past, we would have had an election because a government was defeated. Like, May's government was defeated on its biggest policy, its flagship policy, by a huge majority. In any other circumstance, that would lead to an election, and didn't do.
Yeah.
And so people are starting to think more clearly about the Constitution, if only because they have to try and explain it to Americans.
Yeah, but at the same time, normally when you have these kind of events, the commentators who do know these sorts of things tend to be able to cut through a little bit more. They tend to be getting more views, get more push on social media because they're experts in or their niche field is really relevant for that time period. And what I've not maybe it's happened, but it's I've certainly not seen it, is people kind of talking about this, not just in the sense of what we're going through is bad, but and here's how we prevent it in the future. I don't necessarily think we've seen that. You normally do get at least an underlevel of that in any kind of discussion of these sorts. And you've not, for instance, had any discussion on when it comes to the role of the executive in proroguing Parliament about how do we remove that ability? Why do we have prorogation in that sense? Does it actually make sense for us to shut down Parliament for, you know, conference season and things like that? That isn't something I've seen. And yet that is the sort of thing that you do need to think about, because the reason Boris Johnson was able to prorogue Parliament is because he's able to, it's an ill-defined thing. And unless you are legislating to define it, it can just happen again. And I've not seen that.
Well, people are right. So the Institute for Government has written quite a lot on this, as has David Alan Green, as has Vernon Bogdanore. There's another Oxford academic, and I've forgotten his name, I think it's Chris something, and he's written a blog for one of the Oxford Politics blogs on the Constitution. So I think people are writing about it. I think the problem is, if you're talking about drafting an alternative constitution, it's not just an entire constitution, but this one element. That's the thing. But you're talking about putting a sticking plaster on prorogation, whereas actually, if you're going to draft alternative constitutions, like, you need to think about things like parliamentary government or democratic government. You need to think about these big issues, which, as you said before, they're really complicated. But the whole point is, you need to think about them. It's no good just kind of changing the spokes on the wheel when there is no cart.
Normally those wider kind of like changes tend to be almost like a snowball of something else. So yes, you've got Vernon Bogdanore, yes, you've got David Alan Green and those sorts of people talking about this, but you would expect them to always be the ones talking about this. You don't necessarily have the likes of Owen Jones kind of like commentating and saying, this is, you know, it would come from a different perspective, absolutely. But it is absolutely the sort of thing you would expect to see him say, this is an abuse of power by the Conservative government. This is a gap in the way the law works. We should fix this.
You have seen Aditya Chakraborty write about it in terms of the lack of democratic accountability in terms of academies and free schools and privatising out services and what have you. So I think there is that left critique as well.
I've not seen it to the extent that I would have expected, if I'm being honest. I've not gone looking for it, but then
that might be why.
But again, there is a bit of an issue: is if we are saying we need to kind of raise this kind of as an issue, shouldn't there be a bit more of it just kind of amplified so that the debate is actually able to cut through in some form? Like, so for The Guardian, for instance, how heavily are they as a paper which is massively into these kind of subject matters, actually pushing that sort of stuff? Because, as I say, I'm not necessarily seeing it, which means if I'm not seeing it, an awful lot of other people aren't seeing it, which means they're not being educated on it. So that would be my main...
I think it's certainly in terms of the Chakraborty one, it's the difference, I think, between... I don't think necessarily people on the left talk about the Constitution very much, because essentially they still want a majority Labour government. And they want a Labour government to be able to do things because they have an outdated view of not Aditya Chakraborty, but certain, you know,
yeah,
a lot of people think, well, we can just kind of take power of the commanding heights of the economy and take power of the House of Commons and we can get stuff done and forget that's not how power works anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas traditionally, the matters of the Constitution and of electoral reform are much more those of the liberal strand of British politics. So, you know, it has been an issue for the Liberals and the Lib Dems for years, and the extent that it's been an issue for the Conservatives and Labour tends to be those more small L Liberals in that party, he says, looking at a biography of Roy Jenkins. You're going to see a talk about the Constitution wrapped up in a more general debate about economic inequality and lack of access and privilege, rather than a sort of more legalistic, this is how it works. And certainly, in terms of the prorogation stuff, more in terms of Johnson and his rhetoric generally, mm-hmm, and the anti-democratic rhetoric. So I don't think with Johnson, it's not necessarily that he's doing something that's unconstitutional, I think, that people have talked about. It's the fact that this is a guy who's not bothered about lying, he's not bothered about telling the truth, He's not that bothered about being nice to people who are different to what he is. Yeah. The Brexit campaign is one that calls judges enemies of the people, and that's the thing that they're it's the breaking of the norms rather than the how do we fix the constitution bit.
Yeah, but the issue fundamentally is that the reason breaking the norms matters is because there is no codification of that of those norms in a legal way, and that jump from this is bad to this is the solution, that's what I'm not seeing. And maybe it does get that way, maybe we are too early into this to actually see that. I'm quite prepared to admit that could be the case. God knows what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone in 3 months' time at the moment.
I think that's part of the thing, is at the moment Labour's policy on democracy is to have a royal commission and a citizens' convention to discuss the issue. It's not like with the economy, it's simple. So in terms of the Chakrabarti critique, it's people feel left out and don't have control over their lives. We can stop that by bringing insourcing back. So we've got this kind of democratic accountability to who provides public services. We can stop things like free schools and giving private companies public money, all that kind of stuff. What we don't have necessarily is then the solutions to fix democracy as such. I mean, to be fair, I haven't seen the Lib Dems push electoral reform as well and democratic reform as an issue. I think it's almost because, like, at the moment, there is Brexit.
Yeah, and there's nothing else. There's no bandwidth for anything else for anybody.
Well, because it's hard, it would be the height of self-indulgence to use this national crisis to say, well, maybe we should have single transferable vote, which is what we should talk about next week. Shall we finish?
Yeah.
Yes, we should finish.
We should finish.
Thank you for listening to that. If you want more episodes on the Constitution, of course you do, listeners. Let us know which constitutional issue you would like us to talk about at our website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.